Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on the crisis in Ukraine following a warning by its first post-independence president, Leonid Kravchuk, to Parliament that the country was on the verge of civil war. Jeffrey Mankoff, the Deputy Director and Fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies' Russian and European programs, joins us to discuss the struggle within the country between the pro-European majority and the pro-Russia minority, and the wider impasse between Europe and Russia, between democratic values and power politics. Then we will examine the assault on press freedom by Egypt's military government, with 20 journalists from Al Jazeera facing charges of belonging to terrorist groups, harming national unity and social peace, and spreading false news. An expert on the Arab media, Marwan Krady, a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, joins us to discuss the military's intimidation of the Egyptian press and the role of the chief backers of the military regime, Saudi Arabia, in influencing Arab media and spreading the Saudi royal family's model of feudal politics and reactionary religion. Then finally, we will speak with John Cronin, the Senior Fellow in Environmental Affairs at the Pace Academy for Applied Environmental Studies and the founder and CEO of the Beacon Institute for Rivers and Estuaries. The author with Robert Kennedy Jr. of The River Keepers, he worked for decades with Pete Seeger on cleaning up the Hudson River. He joins us to discuss the life and legacy of Beacon, New York's most famous resident, Pete Seeger, who eschewed celebrity and lived by the motto, think globally but act locally. And joining us now is Jeffrey Mankoff, who's a Deputy Director and Fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Russia and Eurasian Program. He's the author of Russian Foreign Policy, The Return of Great Power Politics, and is a frequent commentator on international security, Russian foreign policy, regional security in the Caucasus and Central Asia, ethnic conflict, and energy security. Previously served as an advisor on U.S.-Russia relations at the United States Department of State as a Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow. And Dr. Mankoff has held academic fellowships at Harvard, Yale, and Moscow State Universities. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeffrey Mankoff.
Thank you.
And the former president, or in fact the first post-independence president of Ukraine, Kravchuk, spoke to the parliament and warned in very dire terms that the country was on the brink of civil war. Is that your understanding?
You know, the situation's certainly gotten worse. I think the potential for, you know, widespread unrest is there. Calling it civil war at this point may be a little bit premature, but I do think that given the dynamics of how the confrontations between the authorities and the protesters have developed over the last couple of weeks, we're definitely, I think, at a tipping point where the possibility of much more serious unrest cannot be excluded.
Well, the first post-Soviet president, you know, Kravchuk, speaking to Parliament, of course, he was speaking to Kuchma was also there, and the other, Yushchenko, who was ousted by the current guy, and who, of course, was poisoned as well. We all recall that. They were all in attendance, and this has followed, of course, the fact that the former prime minister, Azarov, who apparently was widely despised in the country, stepped down. He's known as the family banker because of the Yanukovych's family's flagrant kleptocratic behavior. And he's been replaced by a kind of loyal a flunky, if you will, of Yanukovych's. So they're shuffling the deck, but are they dealing with the crisis itself?
Not so much. It is kind of shuffling the deck chairs on the sinking ship. You know, the protests began back in November in response to Yanukovych's decision to do an about-face on this planned association agreement that he had been intending to sign with the European Union. And that was bad enough, but I think that we've really seen the protest movement grow and spread across the country over the course of the last month or so, in part because the government has failed to address some of the more deep-seated problems that the country faces, and it actually sought to deal with the protests against the EU agreement by using force. And so now, you know, what we have is not people protesting just against decision to turn the country's back on the EU, but on the government's use of force, on its unwillingness to accept alternative points of view, its basic unresponsiveness to the wishes of the society. So if anything, I think what the government has done is it's united a lot of the country against it. You know, Ukraine is a fairly divided country. And, you know, if this was going to be an argument about Russia versus the EU, those divisions, I think, would be very salient. But, you know, right now, I think they've been shunted aside to some degree because you have so much popular fury, popular anger being directed at the government.
And is this largely due to the fact that this ruling family, with the eldest son, a former dentist, basically shaking down the oligarchs, saying, you know, I'm your new partner, and the fact that they've stashed billions away? And, I mean, it's sort of tacky, from my understanding, rather like what happened in Tunisia. You know, the Arab Spring began because the Tunisian people were fed up with the excesses of the first family. Is that what's going on here?
I think that's part of it, but that's not the entire story. You know, in Tunisia, this was you know, years and decades sort of building up, whereas, you know, in Ukraine, they've only had Yanukovych since 2010. But, you know, I think you can definitely see the country kind of moving in that direction. Ukraine, unlike its immediate neighbors, you know, Russia and Belarus, actually has a pretty robust, I don't want to necessarily say democratic, but let's say pluralist politics. And that means that, you know, there's more, the media is a little bit feistier, you know, there are real opposition parties, there are votes that actually lead to transfers of power, which means that it's difficult for this kind of thing, which is not all that unusual, unfortunately, in the post-Soviet world. It's harder to do in a country like Ukraine because there are countervailing forces. There are people who are going to notice what's going on and be able to take political advantage of it. And, you know, to call it tacky, I think, is right, but it also, I think, understates the seriousness of it. And, you know, Yanukovych, I think, was looking around at his neighbors and was thinking, you know, maybe we can build a political system here that looks like what they have in Russia, for example. But unfortunately for him, Ukraine's not Russia.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeffrey Mankoff, who's a deputy director and fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies' Russia and Eurasia program. He's the author of Russian Foreign Policy, The Return of Great Power Politics, and is a frequent commentator on international security, Russian foreign policy, regional security in the Caucasus and Central Asia, ethnic conflict, and energy security. Previously served as an advisor on U.S.-Russia relations at the United States Department of State as a Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow. And Dr. Mankoff has held academic fellowships at Harvard, Yale, and Moscow State Universities. So it's clearly having an effect on the broader EU-Russia relations because the EU-Russia summit that was supposed to last for 2 days in Brussels in the last couple of days ended in just 3 hours. Putin got a pretty chilly reception. He's trying to put on a big show for himself and for Russia at Sochi with the Winter Olympics, and I don't imagine what's happening in the Ukraine is good news for him since he seems to have staked so much on the political survival of Yanukovych.
Mm-hmm. Right. He has a whole host of challenges connected with the Olympics in Sochi, and this, you know, only adds to the bill, I suppose. You know, there's no love lost between Putin and Yanukovych or between Russia and Yanukovych. You know, this was a guy who spent the last couple of years since his inauguration as president touting Ukraine's European ambitions. And it took a lot of arm twisting, carrots as well as sticks on the part of the Kremlin to get him to change his mind. But I don't think there's any illusion in Moscow that if Yanukovych had his choice, this isn't what he would be doing. The problem from their perspective is they don't really have a good alternative. You know, the previous president, Yushchenko, was a very committed pro-European. He had a lot of other faults that ended his political career, but his support for Ukrainian sovereignty, Ukrainian nationalism, and European vocation, I don't think was in question. Yanukovych is a guy who is in political, so figurative as well as literal, debt to Moscow, and even with him, the Kremlin's had a tough time getting him to stand in line. But I think they're also kind of stuck with him. That said, the Russians have made clear in the last couple of days, including during this abortive EU summit, that the carrots that they offered to Ukrainians to get them to turn their back on the EU are not irrevocable. Both the financial assistance in the form of loans and the concessions on gas prices that they offered. So, they continue to have leverage. And I think if Yanukovych were to go, they would obviously watch very carefully what his successor was doing and would make use of the fact that those financial incentives that they offered are contingent, and which they've made clear are contingent.
Well, Jeffrey Manko, given that Putin at the press conference in Brussels made the quip that we'd like to get our money back, referring to the $15 billion loan, and he also went on to say that he didn't mind who was running the place as long as they paid back our money. That's basically what he was saying there. Could they save themselves $15 billion and let the Europeans pick up the tab?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the concern. The first tranche of that loan was only $3 billion, as I understand it. So they have to worry about that. But I think the rest of it, they're kind of waiting and seeing. And that goes for the gas prices concessions as well. Those are going to be reviewed quarterly. So if the Ukrainians do something that they don't like, they can revise those gas prices back up to where they were before. The problem for both Russia, or one of the problems for both Russia and the Europeans, is that Ukraine has an impending budget crisis. They're teetering on the verge of default. And of course, a lot of those debts they owe to Russia for the subsidized gas, or for the gas that they've been receiving and then selling at subsidized prices on the domestic market. And if Russia walks away, yes, there is an enhanced danger of the country tipping into default, but that would also be bad for Russia, not only for its relationship with the West, but also just in terms of its own financial stake in the country.
So how much then is Putin acting out of his sort of geopolitical paranoia about the spread of NATO eastward? Because, basically, I suppose what you could see here in the broader picture is for the Ukrainian people, there are two competing visions of democracy, one that's open, free, and the other one, the one that Putin's offering, which is we may not have the same niceties as they have in Europe, but we have success, and at the same time, of course, it's pretty clear that Putin is turning the clock back in terms of all of the rights, and particularly encouraging the darker side with anti-gay legislation and a very conservative vision of religion. He's stoking all of those fires. So, I'm pretty much editorializing here, saying, I can't understand why anybody would choose the Russian version and not the European version. But give me your sense of how that's playing out inside Ukraine.
Yeah, right. So obviously, the question of NATO expansion hovers over a lot of this, and the real struggles over the post-Soviet space sort of go back to the arguments earlier at the beginning of the 21st century about NATO expansion to Ukraine and also to Georgia. And that's pretty well off the table at this point. NATO said that the door remains open to those countries, but they have a lot of criteria that they need to fulfill before we can start talking about that seriously. And frankly, within NATO, there's very little appetite for pursuing expansion right now. On the question that you raised about democracy and gay rights and things like that, I think there's something kind of instrumental in all of this. It's not to say that Putin doesn't believe in, you know, a particular conception of values that he portrays as being traditional. But I think those are being emphasized now in part with an audience in places like Ukraine in mind. You know, since Putin came back to the Kremlin in 2012, one of his major priorities has been the reconsolidation of the post-Soviet space under Russian suzerainty, at least. He's talked about Eurasia as being a separate entity, not only geopolitical, but also historical and cultural, that it's not part of the West, and that it's not part of Asia, but it's this separate block that exists in between East and West. And as part of that, I think he's trying to play up the historical and cultural differences between Europe, the West, on the one hand, and this Eurasia on the other hand. And so when Putin talks about religion, when he talks about gay rights, doing that, I think, in part to emphasize how Eurasia is not Europe, that there is a fundamental philosophical, moral distinction. And he's counting on, I think, the assumption that most people in Russia, but also in Ukraine and in some of these other post-Soviet countries, accept that or are willing to accept that. One of the arguments that you heard in the run-up to the Vilnius summit when this association agreement between Ukraine and the EU was supposed to be signed, you heard this coming from a lot of Russian commentators, was, you know, why would Ukraine want to sign up for the European Union's standards on gay rights? You know, that's not something that has a lot of support among Ukrainians. And if Ukraine wants to go with the EU, they're going to have to accept things like gay marriage and, you know, all of these other things that are just completely foreign to that culture and that society, which, you know, again, I think this is being done somewhat instrumentally, but that doesn't mean that there's not, that it doesn't find resonance in at least certain constituencies, not only in Russia, but in Ukraine and a lot of the other post-Soviet countries.
But does anybody ask why, you know, these traditional values, if you will, to borrow an American phrase, that Putin is appealing to, why they have to be mutually exclusive with democracy? I mean, what Putin has done in Russia is pretty much kill politics, hasn't he? I mean, it's just a cynical game that's going on there with him and United Russia. And, you know, there was a brief blush or flirtation with democracy there for a while, but he's rolled back every vestige of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they've tried, and for a while it looked like they were pretty successful. You know, in the middle part of the last decade, that ambition seemed to be doing pretty well. You know, they talked about this notion of sovereign democracy, which is basically we decide what democracy means and nobody else has the right to tell us how to do it. There's still a lot of that in the politics and in the discussion in Russia, but I think what you've seen over the last couple of years is that there is politics now. This goes back to really to the 2011 Duma elections, which were rigged quite substantially and which led to, you know, real protests in Moscow and in some of the other cities. And then we saw those protests spread and repeat themselves the next year in the spring when Putin himself was reelected. So there's not united opposition at this point. There's not a cohesive alternative to the status quo. But, you know, if you look at things like Putin's popularity ratings, they're clearly declining, they're stagnating, and people are increasingly looking for alternatives. And I think there's a growing recognition that the system needs more safety valves. So there's been, you know, talk of things like, you know, bringing back municipal elections, for example, which is something that they're, you know, trying to do. And, you know, regardless of what happens in terms of the system, this mobilization from below, I think, is happening and is spreading. It's inchoate at this point, and there's not a unifying figure to bring it all together or a unifying message to unite them. But I think they're forcing the system they're pushing against the system at its weakest points, and they're forcing it to open up around the edges. And so I'd say, whereas, you know, 5 or 6 years ago you could say there's not really politics in Russia, I don't think you can really say that anymore.
Well, Jeffrey Mankoff, I thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeffrey Mankoff, who's a deputy director and fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Russia and Eurasia program. He's the author of Russia and Foreign Policy, The Return of Great Power Politics, and is a frequent commentator on international security, Russian foreign policy, regional security in the Caucasus and Central Asia, ethnic conflict, and energy security. Previously served as an advisor on U.S.-Russia relations at the United States Department of State as a Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow, and Dr. Mankoff has held academic fellowships at Harvard, Yale, and Moscow State Universities. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the jailing of the Al Jazeera reporters in Egypt.
Some cry, but when the sun comes up, when the sun comes up, it will be on my side. It will be on my side.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Marwan Crady, who's a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics and was the founding director of the Arab Media and Public Life Project at American University. His books include Hybridity or The Cultural Logic of Globalization, Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marwan Crady.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
And, Marwan, the Egyptian's military regime now, having named its the Field Marshal Sisi as its candidate for president, has jailed or has charged 20 journalists from Al Jazeera with the most extraordinary charges, that they belong to terrorist groups, they are harming national unity and social peace, and using terrorism as a means to their goals. Apparently, some of these journalists are on the run. The Egyptians, I guess they are. There were 16 Egyptians. The rest are Britons, a Dutch national, and an Australian. But the five are being held, and some have been held there since December.
Yes. Unfortunately, the situation of the media in Egypt today is worse than it was under Mubarak. So it has made full circle and then some. The military regime in charge of Egypt right now sees the media in general as a threat, any kind of independent media as a threat, but specifically they see Al Jazeera as a major threat to their agenda, because Al Jazeera has long been associated with the Muslim Brotherhood. And as you know, not too long ago, Sisi and the ruling military junta in Egypt called the Muslim designated the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization. Since Al Jazeera is closely associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, it's open season on Al Jazeera in Egypt today.
So explain to me this paradox then, that the Sisi government was largely helped by the Temerod movement, and people actually went to the streets and were so fed up with Morsi's mismanagement that there was quite a popular movement against him that ended up with military rule. And my understanding is that what was going on behind the scenes was that the Saudis and others were manipulating gas and diesel wasn't available, food wasn't available. And then suddenly, as soon as the military coup against Morsi took place, money poured in from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, and the gas and diesel and food shows up at the gas pump and on the shelves. But does this mean that Qatar, that owns Al Jazeera, is the odd man out in terms of the money that Sisi's getting from the Gulf. It's from Kuwait, Saudi, and the United Arab Emirates, right? But conspicuously not from Qatar. Is that right?
Absolutely. And this is a very important distinction. Qatar was the main sponsor of the Muslim Brotherhood in the Egyptian Revolution that toppled Mubarak. They remained some of the major supporter, perhaps alongside with Turkey, although Qatar gave more money to Morsi when he was ruling. And the Qataris have always been closed for quite a long time to the Muslim Brotherhood. Yusuf al-Qaradawi, the famous cleric who had his show in Al Jazeera, he was one of the major advisors to the Qatari emir, came from the Muslim Brotherhood. He went to Egypt during the revolution and made a very famous speech in Tahrir Square supporting the Muslim Brotherhood's agenda. And so Qatar is very associated with the Muslim Brothers. The Saudis, on the other hand, especially the Saudis and the Emirati, the UAE authorities, see the Muslim Brotherhood as a very important threat. Saudi Arabia, the Saudi regime, the royal family, sees the Muslim Brotherhood as an alternative, as having an alternative Islamic doctrine for political rule that could undermine the Wahhabi doctrine that is in effect in Saudi Arabia. The UAE government sees the Muslim Brotherhood as some kind of dangerous underground group, as almost a sect that can undermine its system of governance, its power. And so there's definitely a regional agenda being played out. We see the kind of withdrawal of Qatar to a large extent from the Egyptian context and a reassertion of Saudi and UAE power. This is parallel to what's going on in Syria, for instance. The Saudis now are the leading party and the leading sponsor of the opposition, and the Qatari role has receded.
Again, I'm speaking with Marwan Crady, who's a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics and was the founding director of the Arab Media and Public Life Project at American University. And his books include Hybridity, or The Cultural Logic of Globalization, Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. So there's also, is there not, Marwan Crady, a distinction between what the Arab viewers of the Arab language Al Jazeera program see and what Western viewers of the English language Al Jazeera program see, including here in the United States?
Absolutely. And this has been a source of debate since the founding of Al Jazeera English. It was meant to be called Al Jazeera International, but there were fears within the network, because Al Jazeera had officially declared itself a network and no longer a station. So it was a multi-platform network with sports channel, documentary channels, a variety of channels targeting different audiences. When the English channel was launched, there was a lot of questioning as to whether it would heed the editorial line of the Arabic channel, and clearly there were some divergences in the coverage. And now we have Al Jazeera America, in addition to Al Jazeera English, that is really trying to compete in the U.S. market, and therefore does not really follow a recipe, an editorial recipe that would attract Arab viewers. So there are definitely differences in the way they cover events. The main Arabic channel, there's no doubt in my mind that it has been a champion of the Muslim Brothers and Muslim Brotherhood-affiliated political parties wherever they are in the Arab world. We can see it in Egypt very clearly, in the case of Tunisia very clearly, even in the case of Syria. So there's no doubt in my mind. I mean, however, beyond just the context of Al Jazeera itself, we need to look at the broader context of Egyptian media. Egyptian media are in trouble. They're in full crisis mode. There's no money for advertising. They face censorship from political power. They face dwindling audiences. Initially, when the revolution toppled Mubarak, there was huge interest in television. Talk shows achieved huge ratings because people wanted to know what was going on. Famously, there was a prime minister who resigned live online. Today, Egyptian media are in crisis mode. There was an interesting news item today that in a meeting of representatives of major Egyptian television channels, direct attacks were leveled at the Saudis. They even though the Saudi royal family is bankrolling and supporting the Sisi regime, people in the media in Egypt are very resentful against what they see as Saudi attempts to take over the Egyptian media environment, to take over the sector. They accuse it of wanting the large audience of Saudi Arabia. They accuse Saudi princes of wanting to achieve monopoly power over different kinds of programming. And this was very strange. At the same time, if you see it in a long history of the Egyptians are very proud of their media sector, justifiably so. But it's a media sector that has been struggling for the last 20 years. After being dominant in the Arab world, in the last 20 years, the Saudis have been ascendant. A lot of media interests in Egypt are already owned by Saudis. And so the situation is a lot more complicated than to say whoever, you know, who pays the piper plays the tune, right? It's a much more complicated situation that has some unexpected dynamics going on.
But I thought that one of the richest men in Egypt who has a television network is a Coptic Christian, and that was, I don't know whether he was responsible for that, the appearance of that ridiculous film that was made out here in Los Angeles that caused such an uproar in Egypt and by extension in Libya, leading to the killing of the U.S. ambassador in Benghazi, which of course has become a whipping boy for the Republicans.
We don't know for a fact if Mr. Sawiris, the Egyptian mogul, he owns a lot of media interests. He founded a political party in the wake of the revolution. He does support the military regime. He cannot stand the Muslim Brothers. I don't have any evidence that he was related to the infamous video that you mentioned. But again, you know, this is somebody who controls one slice of the Egyptian media market, but he doesn't control the whole market. And the market since the January 2011 revolution has grown extremely quickly in size. And has obviously grown in diversity. So you had some Salafi channels, Muslim Brotherhood affiliated channels, game and music channels. Then you have kind of more mainstream general political channels, and you have the vast state apparatus, the Nilesat channels, which are many channels, many more channels than the Egyptian markets can bear. But since Egypt has Nilesat, the Egyptian government does have a satellite, a geostationary satellite, they have to fill those transponders, and they have many channels. And so it's very difficult to say why and where Mr. Sawiris stands in the current scuffle with Saudi Arabia over the media. There was another event over the summer when the Turkish prime minister accused the military government, accused Mr. Sisi and his supporters of staging a military coup, because Erdogan was a supporter and is still a supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. There was a lot of talk of boycotting Turkish products, boycotting Turkish media productions. So what we see overall is that media, even entertainment, even television drama, even game shows, have become a political bargaining tool of sorts between Egypt, whose media sector is in crisis, and a variety of regional players, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the UAE, and Turkey.
But just back to the 20 journalists who are facing charges in Egypt from Al Jazeera, many of whom are on the run and some of whom are in jail. I'm curious to know, I know that the BBC and Sky Television and the Daily Telegraph have come out very strongly in support of these journalists being held by the military regime. But has there been a groundswell over here, do you think? Are people in our press and those organizations we have here advocating freedom of the press taking this issue on?
I do not believe so. I haven't seen much of it. I mean, of course, in kind of niche circles that are interested in press freedom, you know, I'm on Twitter and I follow and dialogue through Twitter with a lot of like-minded people who are interested in media and the Middle East, who are interested in independent media in the region. And of course, there's an ongoing debate, but I definitely don't see a groundswell of criticism of the Sisi government. Many of us expected President Obama to mention the issue in his State of the Union address. Egypt, as you remember, got nearly no mention. So I definitely wouldn't call it a groundswell. There's concern in some circles, but it remains limited. It remains muffled.
Well, but it's a universal issue. I don't understand how you could bifurcate this.
It is a universal issue, and it's problematic on so many levels. As you said, the majority are of those accused or indicted are Egyptian. The others are foreign nationals, Dutch, Australians, Brits, I believe. And the charges against the two groups are different. The Egyptians are accused of supporting terrorism. The foreigners are accused of spreading false information that harms national security. Those are two very different accusations that carry, different levels of potential punishment, right? If you're accused of being a terrorist, you know what can happen to you. You get tortured, especially when you don't have the protection of a foreign passport. So that's it's problematic at that level. The other reason that it's very problematic is while everybody keeps castigating the Syrian government for doing what it does to foreign journalists, which is abominable, we don't hear the same about Egyptian journalists, perhaps because in Egypt they're not getting killed like they are in Syria, but they're getting harassed more and more in ways that I find particularly disturbing. Not only the scope, the scale of the harassment is increasing, but the intensity, the accusations, the charges leveled against journalists. It's extremely difficult to work as a journalist in Egypt today unless you are supportive of Sisi rule.
Well, Myron Crady, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Myron Crady. He's a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics and was the founding director of the Arab Media and Public Life Project at American University. His books include Hybridity, or The Cultural Logic of Globalization, Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a riverkeeper who worked with Pete Seeger on cleaning up the Hudson River. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Cronin, who's a senior fellow in environmental affairs at the Pace Academy for Applied Environmental Studies at Pace University and the Beacon Institute for Rivers and Estuaries, founding director, chief executive officer, and the Beacon Institute fellow at Clarkson University. He has worked as an advocate, legislative and congressional aide, commercial fisherman, professor, author, and filmmaker, and is known internationally for his Hudson River work. He served as Hudson River Keeper from 1983 to 2000, a position that has inspired a legacy of 200 waterkeeper programs that fight pollution on six continents. John Cronin co-authored The River Keepers with Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Cronin.
Thank you for having me.
And you are a resident of Beacon, New York, and so was Pete Seeger, who died on Monday at the age of 94. He was very much a fixture in your town, was he not?
Pete was a fixture in Beacon. And, it's a testimony to how connected he was with everybody in the community that in the 2 days after he passed away, that Facebook filled up with photographs that people had taken with him. He was, you could see him in the post office, see him in the supermarket, and he was a regular part of the community, working on small community projects and large. And in that regard, he was unique in the world of globally known celebrities.
Well, that was what I thought was so great about him, was that he was a celebrity, but he didn't act like a celebrity. For example, you apparently saw him one time in the middle of the winter on a roadside holding up a sign proclaiming peace against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He hadn't invited the press along. He was just standing there as a lonely citizen making a personal and private protest. That's what I take it is what the beauty of this man was, that he was the embodiment of that old adage, think globally but act locally.
That's precisely what Pete was like. And he shunned the trappings of celebrity and was very wary of celebrity. He used his worldwide reputation as a vehicle for delivering very important messages about civil rights and about world peace and about the environment. But he didn't just do that at concerts, and he didn't just do that in the United States and other nations on a national and international scale. The example you just used, it was very startling. It was a cold, sleety winter day. Where we're on a major highway, we were all driving 15 miles an hour, and I recognized Pete right away because his ramrod posture is recognizable to anybody who knows him. And he had his back to me because he was facing traffic in the other direction. And as I went past him, he was holding up a sign that said peace, and he was wrapped in a scarf with a knit hat. You couldn't make out it was Pete unless you knew it was Pete, and. And he was holding up this sign to oncoming traffic, and he was all by himself. He didn't notify the press. He didn't alert anybody. I parked my car and went over across the street and said, Pete, can I get you a hot drink? And he said to me, no, but I have a sign you can hold. So I stood there with him and held the sign for another hour. That's what Pete was like.
Again, I'm speaking with John Cronin, who's a senior fellow in environmental affairs at the Pace Academy for Applied Environmental Studies at Pace University and the Beacon Institute for Rivers and Estuaries, founding director, chief executive officer, and the Beacon Institute fellow at Clarkson University. He's worked as an advocate, legislative and congressional aide, commercial fisherman, professor, author, and filmmaker, and is known internationally for his work on saving the Hudson River. He served as Hudson Riverkeeper from 1983 to 2000, a position that has inspired a legacy of 200 waterkeeper programs that fight pollution on six continents. And John Cronin co-authored The Riverkeepers with Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. But in terms of, I mean, as a resident of Beacon, somebody that built his own log cabin, hewing the wood himself, laying down the foundations, when he started to build his log cabin 65 years ago, the river was thoroughly polluted, the Hudson, to the point where Bobby Kennedy Jr. said that, you know, that boats would come up from the Caribbean so that the polluted water would eat the, you know, the bugs off the hull of these boats. That was how toxic it was. So give me a sense of this great environmental success story. And by the way, people don't realize that Pete Seeger's work on cleaning up the Hudson led to the Clean Water Act of 1972, which he had a hell of a lot to do with getting passed.
Well, if you said to Pete that he had anything to do with getting the Clean Water Act passed, he would have shunned it. You know, he didn't take credit for anything. But it's hard to imagine now that not only how bad a condition the Hudson was in the 1960s and 70s, but also how much anti-environmental sentiment there was in the country. So if back then, and Pete had the idea for the 106-foot Clearwater sloop as a symbol and as an education vessel and as the beginning of a movement on the Hudson River, he had that idea at a time when if you were anti-pollution, you were considered by most people to be a communist or a troublemaker or an agitator. It was very different than it is now, where environment is considered a worthy and an important and honorable cause. A large part of the nation didn't think so. And, you know, Pete had a long history of advocacy and paid the price for it during the communist scare era of the 1950s. when he was blacklisted for his advocacy and politics. So how you have to picture him is as somebody who could not only envision a clean river where there was only a filthy one, but as somebody who was willing to stand up to the slings and arrows of those who would call you names if you were pro-environment, and who was willing to put himself out there as a voice for that movement in the very shortly after he had been beat up quite badly in the press and elsewhere for his advocacy work for civil rights and peace in the labor movement. So he's an extraordinarily courageous figure. And I spoke at an event a couple of years ago of several hundred people that Pete played at. And I said to the crowd as I was introducing him, I said, I want a show of hands of how many people here were inspired to care about the environment by Pete Seeger. And virtually every hand in the room went up. And that would be true for the Hudson River from its source down to the Atlantic Ocean. He's had that big of an impact. And then the Hudson, of course, has inspired environmentalism all over the country.
And just to give our audience an idea of how hostile people were to environmentalists back in the early 1970s when Pete Seeger started in the 60s, and as a matter of fact, the campaign to clean up the Hudson. Apparently, in the 1970s, a state senator was elected to represent Orange County, New York, with a campaign theme, out of work and hungry, eat an environmentalist. God.
I remember it well. Richard Schermerhorn was his name. He ran on that slogan, out of work and hungry, eat an environmentalist. And you could see those bumper stickers on cars and trucks everywhere in the 1970s. And he won very easily. Now, you fast forward to 2014, and there is not an official anywhere in our region or the state of New York who could get elected with that kind of slogan or attitude. Pete deserves the lion's share of the credit for that huge sway in public opinion, for that critical mass that decided, you know what, the river is as important to our life and to our quality of life as anything else in society. I should add as a footnote that eventually Richard Schermerhorn went to jail. So.
Well, you know, he's probably in that category of patriotism as the last refuge of the scoundrel, right?
I think that you nailed it with that, yeah.
Right. So, again, John Cronin, one of the quiet things that Pete Seeger did for your town and his town, Beacon, New York, was to turn a kind of garbage dump into a riverside park for children, where children today, particularly, obviously, in the summer, can swim in the Hudson, the clean water that Pete Seeger helped restore and bring about. I mean, to me, that's unassailable. I mean, people are not stupid. They're not retrograde. They recognize good things, don't they? I mean,
absolutely. And I think that one of the great things that Pete understood about people was that people were inherently good, that people would be moved by smart ideas, and that people would be moved by the river if they had a chance to experience it. And, you know, I started in 1973, and Pete's the person who got me started on Hudson River work as a volunteer, and his had enormous influence over my life. And I remember him saying in 1973, you know, if we all work together, we can clean up the Hudson River. And back then, I thought he was out of his mind. But I have to tell you, 40 years later, after being involved in lawsuits against over 100 polluters and as a lobbyist and as a congressional aide and you know, through as many different kinds of environmentalism as you can think of, there is no truer lesson than if we all work together, we can win against extraordinary odds. And what Pete meant by that, though, was very important to understand. He didn't mean if we all work together against bad guys. What he meant is we all have to work together If you work for a corporation, if you work for a nonprofit group, if you're a fisherman, if you're a sailor, if you're a teacher or a student, if you run a print shop, there is something for all of us to do. And to his dying day, this is something he believed in with all his heart and soul and never, ever wavered from it. And that's been a source of inspiration to myself and thousands of people. And what he did with that park is kind of a metaphor for all that. It was a garbage dump. And Pete looked at it, and he saw a park. And he spent years convincing local officials and others that this could be a park, and was able to eventually garner a government grant. And now it's one of the prettiest parks in the Hudson River Valley that children and parents use all the time. It's a site for concerts. And at one time, it was a garbage dump. But that's not what he saw when he looked at it. He saw Riverside Park. And that is Pete to the core. You know, he can look at something ugly, and see where the beauty might lie. He can look at somebody who perhaps has taken a bad position on an issue or an anti-environmental position, and he can find in that person a quality or a skill or a piece of knowledge that could actually make the environment better. He was a believer. And as I said, and I say over and over again, you know, thousands of us stand on his shoulders. And I think the big message I've learned in my career, the big idea I've learned in my career, is to hold to that no matter how discouraging things might be, that good is the direction that things end up going in.
Well, clearly, John Kernan, there's much to be done, isn't there? Look what just happened in West Virginia. The whole town of Charleston, 300,000 people without water for weeks and weeks, and still there's some doubt about how clean and safe the drinking water is. It just shows you, I mean, they were polluting that river forever with impunity. And clearly, the lessons learned from Pete Seeger need to be learned in West Virginia, to say the least.
And all over the country. And, you know, every example like that, like the West Virginia spill on the Elk River, every example like that creates for us a magnifying glass to look at the rest of the nation. And so for the West Virginia spill on the Elk River is a perfect example of that. People wondered after the spill happened, why was it that toxic chemicals were being stored so close to a drinking water intake? Well, take a look around the country. Toxic chemicals and hazardous chemicals and petrochemicals and gasoline and oil are routinely stored next to waterways and routinely transported on train cars that run right next to waterways. There are still many things that we have to face, and the West Virginia spill happened in a way that could have happened in hundreds of places around the country. It was not unique in that regard. So you're quite right. We have a long way to go. And Pete understood that. He understood that always, that there was always going to be work to be done. But think about how the nation reacted to that West Virginia spill. If this was 1970 or even 1975, it would not have been a national story. There would not have been nationwide attention on it. People would not have thought of it as outrageous. It probably would have never have made the news. But that change in public opinion, that wave of public opinion now that says we have to be careful, we have to be concerned that the environment and our health are one and the same, has an awful lot to do with the message that Pete has delivered not just throughout New York State but all over the nation and others who have been inspired by his message. It's news today because of a heightened consciousness, not just because of a diligent press.
Well, John Cronin, I thank you very much for joining us here today. Again, John Cronin is a senior fellow in environmental affairs at the Pace Academy for Applied Environmental Studies at Pace University and the Beacon Institute for Rivers and Estuaries, founding director, chief executive officer, and the Beacon Institute fellow at Clarkson University. He's worked as an advocate, legislative and congressional aide, commercial fisherman, professor, author, and filmmaker, and is known internationally for his work on saving the Hudson River. He served as the Hudson River Keeper from 1983 to 2000, a position that has inspired a legacy of 200 water keeper programs that fight pollution on six continents. And John Cronin co-authored The River Keepers with Robert F. Kennedy. And we'll go out, John, with Pete Seeger singing about his work, I guess when his work was just beginning. The song is entitled Sailing Up My Dirty Stream.
And it inspired me when I first heard it.
Sailing down my dirty stream, still I love it, and I'll keep the dream that someday, though maybe not this year, my Hudson River will once again run clear. It starts high in the mountains of the north, crystal clear and icy trickles forth, with just a few floating wrappers of chewing gum dropped by some hikers to warn of things to come. At Glens Falls, 5,000 honest hands work at the consolidated paper plant. 5 million gallons of waste a day. Why should we do it any other way? Down the valley, 1 million toilet chains find my Hudson so convenient place to drain. And each little city says, who, me? Do you think that sewage plants come free? Out in the ocean, they say the water's clear, but I live right at Beacon here. Halfway between the mountains and the sea, tacking to and fro, this thought returns to me. Will it sailing up my dirty stream? Still I love it and I'll dream that someday, though maybe not this year, my Hudson River and my country will run clear.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.